All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're diving into something pretty tricky, huh? Like, what happens when a business partnership ends because a marriage does?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely not as straightforward as splitting up a house or bank account.
Right. We're using a really important case from 1993, Shiller v. Shiller, as our guide here. This is Florida, by the way.
Yep, Florida case. But it's had a huge ripple effect. So many states look to Shiller to figure out how to handle these situations, when a couple owns a business together and then gets divorced.
Right. It's like way more common than people might think, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Especially these days with so many people starting businesses together.
So basically, what we're trying to do today is figure out what Shiller v. Shiller really teaches us,
Right.
right? What are the big takeaways for anyone dealing with a divorce where there's a business involved? Like, what are the things you got to know?
Absolutely, that's the key. What are the must-knows?
Okay, let's set the scene a bit. So we've got Carl and Ann Shiller married in 1958, like way back.
Okay, 1958. Got it.
Ann was super supportive of Carl's business, Daytona Mold, which made steel molds.
It sounds pretty industrial.
Oh, yeah, very much so. But here's the thing. Carl owned the business with his brother, Herman, as a 50-50 partnership.
Okay, so right from the start, it's not just Carl's business to divide, right?
Right, Herman's in the mix too, which makes things more interesting.
A lot more interesting, yeah.
Now, later on, Carl and Herman started another partnership, S&S Associates.
Another one.
Yeah, this one was all about the real estate where Daytona Mold actually operated. So you've got the business itself as one partnership, and then the land it's on as another, both with Carl and his brother.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's like adding a layer of complexity for sure.
Exactly. It's not just a simple split of one business.
Yeah.
Now, here comes the big issue. Carl and Ann get divorced.
Okay, here we go. The plot thickens.
And the trial judge? Well, he decides to award Ann half of Carl's interest in S&S Associates, the real estate one.
It's pretty logical on the surface, right? Like split it down the middle.
Yeah, that's what you'd think, right?
Yeah.
But here's the twist. Carl appeals the decision. He's saying the court overstepped its bounds by doing that.
Wait, so he's saying the court can't just split his partnership interest like that?
Exactly. And that's where things get really interesting, legally speaking.
Okay, I'm all ears. Tell me more.
So the big thing here is how Florida's Uniform Partnership Act, and honestly a lot of other states too, defines what a partner's interest really is.
Gotcha, the legal nitty-gritty.
Right. They say it's personal property, but it's not like owning a car or a house. It's mainly about your right to get profits and any extra money from the business, not actually owning the stuff the partnership has.
Interesting. So it's more like owning a right to money rather than owning the actual building in this case.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you own the potential for profit, but not bricks and mortar.
I see, I see.
And this is super important because it affects how the court can actually deal with this interest legally.
Especially because we've got Herman, right? The other partner who's not part of the divorce.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Herman's a key player here. See, the Uniform Partnership Act is set up to protect partnerships from being, like, totally disrupted by things like divorce.
Yeah, that makes sense. You can't have someone's personal life messing up the whole business.
Right. So the law is there to protect the other partners, like Herman, who are not involved in the divorce. Imagine if the court just gave half of Carl's share to Anne. That would basically be forcing Herman into a new partnership without his say-so.
Oh, yeah. Like suddenly he's got a new business partner he didn't choose.
Yeah, exactly. And that could totally change how the business is run, decision-making, profits, everything.
Makes total sense. So the trial court was wrong to just give Anne half, right?
Right. The appellate court said, nope, can't do that. They overturned it and said the right tool to use is what's called a charging lien.
A charging lien, huh? What's that all about?
Well, it's basically court order that puts a claim on the money Carl gets from the partnership. Like whatever profits or distributions he's supposed to receive, the lien attaches to that.
So it's not giving Anne ownership, but it's making sure she gets the money that represents her share of the value.
Exactly. It's saying, hey, Anne's entitled to this amount, and we're putting a legal hold on Carl's payouts from the partnership until she gets what she's owed.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. So it's like satisfying the debt, but not actually making her a partner.
Exactly. It's protecting the partnership, Herman, and still making sure things are fair financially for Anne.
Very clever. So, how does this charging lien actually work in practice? How do they make sure Anne gets her money?
Well, the appellate court gave a few options. One is to just sell Carl's interest in the partnership and use that money to pay Anne.
Ah, a forced sale, basically.
Yeah. But even that would probably depend on what the partnership agreement says and if Herman has any rights to buy Carl out first.
Right. Gotta follow the rules of the partnership.
The other common thing is appointing a receiver. This person basically takes over collecting Carl's share of the profits and sends that money to Anne until she's been paid in full.
Gotcha. So like a financial middleman. Makes sense.
And the court also said there could be other ways to do it, as long as they're legally sound and Anne gets the money she's entitled to.
So lots of flexibility, but the main point is that Anne gets the financial value without becoming a partner herself.
Exactly. That's the big takeaway from Schiller.
Now, there was also the whole issue of attorney's fees in this case. What happened there?
Oh, yeah, good point. That's another important part of the Schiller case. So the trial court originally said Carl had to pay all of Anne's legal fees from the divorce.
Interesting. But the appellate court changed that, didn't they?
They sure did. They reversed it. And it all comes down to a pretty important principle in divorce law.
Okay, lay it on me. What's the principle?
It's all about what happens when the divorcing couple ends up with roughly the same amount of assets after everything's been split up.
Oh, so like in Schiller, where they basically divided things 50-50.
Exactly. In those cases, the appellate court said it's usually not fair to make one person pay the other person's legal fees.
I can see why. It's about keeping things financially even.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The idea is that if you're both starting your post-divorce lives with a similar amount of money, you should both be responsible for your own lawyer bills.
Makes sense to me.
But just to make things even more interesting, one of the judges who agreed with the decision, Judge Diamantis, had a slightly different take on it.
Oh, there's always a twist, right?
Always. So the concurring opinions, sometimes they can really bring in those nuances that make cases so fascinating.
They sure can. What did these judges add to the conversation?
Well, Judge Griffin really hammered home the importance of protecting partnerships and partners who aren't involved in the divorce, like Herman. He said allowing a direct transfer of partnership interest in a divorce would just wreck the whole system of partnership law.
Totally agree. It would be chaos if anyone's divorce could just upend a whole business partnership.
Yeah, it would throw everything into disarray. So Judge Griffin was very much focused on the bigger picture of business law.
Got it. And what about Judge Diamantis? What was his take?
Well, he agreed with reversing the attorney's fees thing, you know, saying Carl shouldn't have to pay for all of Anne's legal bills. But he also thought there should be a bit more wiggle room, a case-by-case look at things. He was like, even if you split the assets equally, there might be other things going on financially that mean it's fair for one person to pay some of the other person's fees.
Ah, so a bit more flexibility, not just a hard and fast rule.
Right. He's saying, look, sometimes there might be a good reason to shift some of those costs, even if the assets are split evenly. You got to look at the specifics of each case.
Makes sense. Like, maybe one person makes way more money than the other, even if they're walking away with the same amount of assets.
Exactly. So even though the main ruling in Schiller gave us a general rule about attorney's fees, those concurring opinions are a good reminder that sometimes you got to dig a little deeper. You can't always just apply a one-size-fits-all approach.
Totally. It's about looking at the whole picture.
Okay, so we've covered a lot about Schiller v. Schiller. Let's wrap it up and talk about why this case is still so important today.
All right, let's bring it all home.
Why should anyone who's studying law or already practicing care about this case from 1993?
Well, first of all, Schiller makes it crystal clear that a partner's interest in a business isn't like any other asset in a divorce. You can't just divide it up and hand it over.
Right, the charging list. That's the way to go.
Exactly. That's the key. It's about finding a way to make things financially fair without disrupting the whole partnership.
Makes sense. What else do we learn from Schiller?
Schiller also tells us that the way you divide the assets is really connected to who pays the lawyer bills. If both parties walk away with roughly the same amount of money, it's generally not cool to make one person shoulder the burden of all the legal fees.
Right. Fairness all around.
Exactly. And last but not least, Schiller reinforces the idea that you can't just ignore partnership law because you're trying to sort out a divorce. Courts have to work within the laws that govern partnerships, even if it means getting creative.
It's like respecting the boundaries of different areas of law.
Right. Yeah. It's not about just finding the easiest solution. It's about finding the right solution, the legal solution. And this is super relevant today because more and more couples are owning businesses together. Schiller v. Schiller is like the go-to case for figuring out these messy situations.
So basically, Schiller shows us how family law and business law collide and how important it is to understand those intersections. It's not just about dividing stuff up. It's about understanding the nature of what's being divided.
Yeah, and it's about recognizing that there might be other people involved, like those non-spouse business partners who have their own rights and interests.
That's a really good point, and it leads us to something for our listeners to ponder. Given all the protections for partnerships that we see in Shiller, how could prenuptial agreements be used to sort all this stuff out ahead of time? You know, to make sure everyone's protected if a divorce happens down the road.
That's a really great question to think about. Like, how can we use these legal tools to plan for the future and potentially avoid some of these messy situations?
Definitely something for all the aspiring lawyers out there to consider. Cases like Shiller are full of lessons, and those lessons can help you navigate these complex situations when you're out there practicing law.
Couldn't agree more.
So, that's our deep dive into Shiller v. Shiller. Hope you enjoyed it. Until next time.
See you then.